Hi, I'm Leslie Lindenauer, Director of the Center for Excellence in Learning and Teaching at Western Connecticut State University in sunny Danbury, Connecticut. So there are plenty of people who listen to us when we talk about our jobs and say, that must be the best job in the whole world. That must be great because you have all this time off. That must be terrific because you can, you know, control the way you work. Your labor is totally in your control. And there's some truth to that. But if I talk to almost all of my colleagues, they would say the hardest part of our job is grading. The hardest part of our job is assessing our students. You know, most of us have been up in the middle of the night trying to grade stuff that we promised students we'd have back within a week. And we spend an inordinate amount of time on each and every assignment, making sure that we provide feedback that will be helpful. And it's exhausting. There are all sorts of permutations, though. There are all sorts of ways that we can honor the commitment to assessment, that we can still provide the kind of feedback and growth opportunities for our students that we want them to have, and make it a little bit easier for us to navigate that world. Joining us today is Dr. Joshua Rosenthal, a professor in the Department of History, Philosophy, and World Perspectives, to talk a little bit about his experiences with what has, I think, affectionately been called ungrading or contract grading in the world of higher education. Welcome, Joshua.
Hi, thank you.
So, go ahead.
No.
Okay, so.
Thanks for having me.
So, I guess the most important question is why? Why did you decide to take this adventure? Why did you decide to venture into the world of alternate grading and alternate assessments?
That's a good question. I guess the answer is I never felt like I did a good job with what I viewed as conventional methods of grading. They never seemed great to me, and they seemed, as time went on and the world has changed around us, especially including because of technology, they seem to be less and less useful for ways of measuring, if that's the word, what it is I wanted to see that students had learned, right? So when I grew up in a system, I came up and succeeded more or less in a system where walking into a room and being able to take a test that demonstrated you held a certain amount of factual knowledge in your head was rewarded, and then that you could sit down and write a new essay responding to a specific prompt that tested both your insight and had you done all the work. And those were things that I, despite my terrible handwriting and poor writing at the time, I managed to do well enough, right? And then when I started teaching, I set out, because at that time we had almost no pedagogical training, I just kind of tried to replicate that, writing tests and giving essays or short answers and some sort of combination, and then perhaps assigning papers to students on a fairly set amount of topics that you would grade as best you can. But essentially, you would return a student to a paper and say things like, yeah, that's just a B paper, some sort of combination of their writing and their insight. But if a student said, well, why is it a B paper? The truth was, it just felt like a B paper. And I didn't have a clear sense of what distinguished a B from a B minus or a C plus. I just didn't have that skill. And then as time went on, people introduced me to rubrics and to grading carefully and to writing really careful tests. And I'm not super skilled at any of those things, that kind of organizational presentation. And then as I'm wrestling with how to deal with that, a couple of other things happen. One is I realized that a lot of that kind of grading and teaching is predicated upon your authority as an authority figure, both intellectual and as some sort of you're in charge person, and it often leads to fights and disputes with students about, is this a B? And they say, well, my friend wrote a similar paper and they got an A minus. And then you get upset because why are they doing that? And I just realized that when I started teaching, I was invested in winning fights with students. And then I think a lot of men suffer through for much longer than they should. But I realized that even if you won an argument with a student, you never really won. Because if you win some kind of dispute with a student, they disengage with you intellectually. So that's not productive pedagogy, to be winning arguments with your students, right? So you want to present them with as clear an explanation of what they will be assessed on, to use that word, as possible. And if you're talented at writing rubrics, that's not a problem. I am not talented at writing rubrics. And then the other thing is, of course, with the revolution in technology and all of this thing, is the nature of what we know, how we know, and what's important has changed dramatically. So just, it used to be if a student just could remember all the stuff, like that was going to get them a B. And a lot of what history classes did was found ways to convince students to spend time to remember the stuff, dates, names, geography, some cause and effect, things like that. But none of us remember this. I mean, yes, your history professor and your history nerd friend still remember all the stuff because that's how we're wired. But like, we don't remember the same way we did in the 80s or 90s or 2004, because we all walk around with a supercomputer in our pocket and we all have Wikipedia. Just the our brains are different. And I don't engage in, you know, I haven't read a lot of cognitive stuff, but it's clear our brains are different. And moreover, I am no longer like the guardian of information that is hard to access, right? That was the case when I was in college. The professor simply had access to information I didn't. Like, in theory, my students have access to all the information. So I just sort of tore that all up, and I've been groping towards a way of implementing that in my classes. I gave up giving tests years ago. I don't, with all due respect to my colleagues who give tests and use them effectively, I don't see the value of a kind of like, for this 45 minutes, demonstrate to me you have this information in your head. I don't know how that reflects a kind of lasting acquisition of critical skills. So I gave up tests. So my classes are all kind of papers, response journals, you know, any kind of mechanism I can to push students to engage with the material. So I was doing that. And then when I saw a description of contract grading, or spec grading, it's sometimes called, which is specifications grading. It's short for specifications grading. Please tell me if I'm running out of time, because I will just ramble on.
Yeah, good.
And it just seemed to me like that was the solution, because the first thing, to me, spec grading does two things. One is it lets a student consciously choose. You set up levels of work, and a student can say, I'm doing this much work, and I'll get a C or a B or an A. So one, it makes clear something that happens with a lot of students anyway. You see students check out and say, I'm just going to get a C in this class, I don't care. But this way, they're consciously saying, I am going to do X amount of work, and that will get me a C. My fantasy is, of course, to teach a class where everyone gets an A. That's what I'm shooting for. I don't care about a curve. I want to destroy any curve. I want all my students to take all my classes and all get A's, and I don't see any reason why they shouldn't. It hasn't happened yet, but that's my goal. But this lets students take authority over their own grade, and I think that sense of powerlessness, you do work and you send it off into the void and maybe the professor will give it a good grade, like that's toxic, right? It's always been toxic, but now life is just more fraught than it was when we were coming up. And so if you present them and say, you do this much work, it's a C, this much it's a B, this much it's an A, it takes a lot of that I'm this arbitrary authority with power, whether I deserve it or not. So that gets taken off the table, which I love, right? And then the other thing, and I don't know if this is always a part of spec grading or it's something I saw, but somebody, I was reading about it, and it was just, they sort of said, I only grade papers on whether they're good enough or not. This is the way I talk about the paper, either is good enough and they're done, or it needs more work. And all and our students today do not edit and rewrite. They just don't, because they've gotten this far by not doing that. And when you're grading papers, though, I rarely can claim to have lost sleep and stayed up into the night to grade papers, unlike some of my colleagues. I don't know if I've done that, and certainly not in a long time. You're grading a paper and you're, you know, it's late and it's not good and it kind of didn't do the things you wanted to do. And so you end up giving it like a C plus or something because they kind of did what you want, but you feel bad about yourself for letting this student get a C plus on a paper that's really quite terrible, but is acceptable by the standards of our day. Like, yes, in 1982, it would have been an F, right? But like, whatever. And so you give it a C plus and you just feel terrible about yourself. And you feel like either you feel like the student's cheating you or you're letting the student cheat themselves, right? And that just doesn't feel right. And so the way I've adopted this grading system is work is either good enough or it's not good enough. And if it's not good enough, you can return it to the student and say, this work's not good enough. Here's how I think you can make it better so that it's good enough. So one, I get to ask for rewrites. And what I want is for when a student hasn't done the task that I've asked them to do, I want them to do it. I don't want to punish them for being inadequate. I'm not teaching them to be heart surgeons, right? This isn't Spanish where if they don't understand the subjunctive, they can't read poetry, right? I want them to think about cause and effect, history, all those things. So if I do that and I say, it's not good enough, here's what you can do to make it good enough, then one, again, it's a less toxic relationship between me and the student. Two, I get to ask for so many more rewrites than I used to do. And rewriting is where writing and thinking actually happens, right? And that too, in addition to life being different, like our brains are different. I personally don't think, when we're thinking about grading, like the number of times in our lives when we are graded on a scale of like 1 to 100 or 1 to 5, I think is very few compared to the amount of times in life where the question is, was it good enough or not, right? I think as we move forward in life, if college is a way to train students to think about life, like way more often you're going to be in a situation where it's like, that was good enough or that was not good enough. I mean, cancer survival rates are matters of percentages, and we could talk about an A through F scale, or, you know, because it's a lot of 5 years, that kind of thing. But like, did you get the mortgage? Did you get the job? You know, did you, you know, like those tend to be either or decisions, and the goal is to just, you know, get the yes. And so in some ways, I don't know, I don't understand why the rules of academia have to be so different from most of the rules of ordinary life. And this seemed to me a much more productive way to kind of have this fit with the way I think a lot of life works. So that was also really appealing to me.
That makes perfect sense. And I will say that I don't give tests in my classes either, or quizzes. I haven't yet made the jump to ungrading or spec grading or contract grading. Listen, in the last minute, I'm hoping that I'll be able to convince you to do a workshop on this where we can talk about the mechanics, but that's not the time or place. Now is not the time or place for that. In the last minute, just talk a little bit about the student's reaction to this system.
Well, when they talk to me, I don't know if I'm getting the unvarnished truth, but I have to say it's like almost always positive. Like if they're ones who just kill multiple choice tests, they don't say like, I miss my multiple choice tests. It's just like, and again, I get away with a lot of stuff. Like I'm a white guy in my 50s, and I project a certain kind of image that I don't get tons of grief from students the way a lot of other people do. But like my experience has been, you know, near universal. Like that's good. Like I understand it, and I'm like, you're giving them authority over their own process, and I think we're so desperate for that. And so much of what makes school terrible is we put young people in a position and we tell them, because I have a degree, my word is final. And it's like, that sucks. Like people want an opportunity to control their own fate. And this gives them that opportunity. In reality, I still have high rates of like really low grades because students don't do the work. And I'm like, I can't, but I don't have to pretend that, like, okay, I'll give you a C minus because you did some crap at the end of the semester. I can just be like, you handed me stuff with one day left and it's not good enough. That's, you know, that's a low grade. I'm sorry. But like the dynamic of like that I'm granting them something has been removed. And so I don't know, like Foucault or feminism, like let's take as much of the unnecessary power relationships out of these dynamics. Like I want to help people learn and think. And me being an authority, I have some expertise in subject knowledge and experience in teaching. But like authority, like why should I have authority? Like that's nonsense.
It's a perfect way to end this conversation, although I hope we'll have more. Thank you so much for your time. Oh, it was our pleasure. Thanks, Joshua Rosenthal, professor in the Department of History, Philosophy, and World Perspectives. In the coming weeks, watch out for, listen for conversations about the best and worst courses we've ever taught and taken, and conversations about the magic of Danbury, Connecticut, also called Hat City. So thank you, and thank you, as always, to our director, Scott Volpe, and to producer and engineer extraordinaire, Pete Puccio.
Thank you, Scott, and thank you, Pete. Thank you, Leslie.
You're welcome.
Tipple is a production of WCSU Media, engineered by Peter Puccio and produced by Scott Volpe. Listen and subscribe on Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at WCSU Podcasts and on the university's Facebook and Twitter pages. And feel free to reach out to us by email at podcasts@wcsu.edu. Thanks for listening.